following A2A one-on-one feature is a production of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. The views and opinions expressed by our guests do not necessarily reflect those of A2A or advocates, allies, or ally organizations. We hope you'll find this interview both informative and inspiring. And now, here's our host, Liz St. John.
Dr. Stephen Post is the director for the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook University Medical School. He has spent decades conducting and promoting research on the physical and mental benefits of compassion and altruism. He's here today to explain why it's good to be good. Stephen, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure, Liz. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about the science. When we help others, or even think about helping others, what happens in our brain?
When we contemplate contributing to the lives of others, most people feel a sense of tranquility. A part of the brain, the mesolimbic pathway, which is deeply evolved and the emotional part of the brain system, where a lot of feelings of gratification and happiness seem to be more or less located, that gets active based on PET scan studies, and those have been replicated quite a few times. So there is something going on in the brain. People speak about a helper's high when they're actually face-to-face engaged in helping others, but there is definitely lots of evidence that when people simply focus their minds and ask themselves imaginatively, what can I do to improve the lives of the people around me? There is a kind of calming effect, and you even have a kind of turning off of some of the emotional pathways associated with bitterness and hostility and so forth.
What do we know about the evolutionary biology of our brain rewarding us with those good hormones when we help others?
Darwin, early on, mainly talked about survival of the fittest in terms of individual selection theory. So me against you for some desirable object in the environment otherwise unspecified. But as he grew older and wrote later on The Descent of Man, he pointed out that a lot of evolution occurs between groups. And group A will do well vis-a-vis group B to the extent that group A has evolved within it all kinds of helping behaviors, empathic qualities, all of the kinds of compassionate affect, the empathy, altruism, axis, all these things that we know are well established and in fact do have hormonal correlates. We know that oxytocin, for example, is involved, and there is a release of endorphins under certain circumstances. One could go on for a long time, and it's a relatively nascent science, but evolutionarily, Darwin would say it makes perfect sense, because the more that kind of behavior is wired into us and connected with internal feelings of joy and gratification, the better off our group will be vis-a-vis the other group. Of course, he also pointed out that there is this problem of conflict between in-group and out-group, and he thought that we needed to use all the philosophy and spirituality we could to focus ourselves on a shared humanity and overcome all these differences that really don't logically amount to anything.
Seems that what you're talking about right there, we could use some of that right now in the world.
Well, we sure could. And, you know, I tell you, you know, there's some interesting studies now on meditation in the schools, meditation in all kinds of different environments. It does seem as though one of the side effects of meditation is that you remove your focus from the concentration on the self and on chronological time or the stresses and pressures that you feel when you're running from point A to point B to point C. I call it a New York strut, being in New York these days. And so you actually open up space to be attentive to the other. And there are some connections between helping behavior and meditational states. In fact, His Holiness the Dalai Lama points out that, at least from his tradition, these kinds of contemplative states are always supposed to be associated with helping behavior. but they do seem to lend themselves to it by deflecting attention from the normal preoccupations of life and kind of opening the consciousness up to the needs of others.
You talk about give and live better. And if you live by the golden rule, you'll be happier, healthier, resilient, creative, and hopeful. Explain how this works or give examples.
Well, it doesn't always work if you're overwhelmed. I work in a hospital, and we have a lot of people here, clinicians, nurses, and the like, and they're involved in helping professions. So for them, the issue is, can they step back? Can they smell the roses? Can they have balance in their life? Can they pursue hobbies? Can they walk by the ocean? Because otherwise, they will lose the meaning of things and become very routinized. They'll feel like they're just cogs in the wheel and so forth. But for the everyday folks, there's no question that just an hour or two a week of volunteering, formally or informally, does seem to make a difference. In one national survey, it showed, I was a consultant for this, that in, the beginning of 2010, looking back on the year 2009, in 2009, about 41% of Americans volunteered on average roughly 100 hours a year. So break it down, could be a couple of hours a week, but not a lot. And then we asked, well, how does that make you feel? Do you feel happier? 96% say yes. Do you feel less stressed? 73% say yes. Do you feel physically healthier? 68% say yes. Do you feel that you can handle loss and disappointment better? 77% say yes. Do you feel that you have deeper friendships? Yes. Do you feel that you sleep better? Yes. Now, because a quarter of these respondents were volunteering through their workplace and not getting docked, by the way, on their paycheck, how do you feel about your employer? And, of course, they're all saying that they find work more meaningful and they're proud of the places they work in. So that's a pretty good deal. And I wasn't surprised, you know, just thinking about this. I was involved in a little write-up on widows and widowers. It turns out that the widows and widowers, having been happily married for a long, long time, they go through some grief and bereavement. The ones who can self-report helping activities in their environment, again, not necessarily formally, they get through the process of bereavement more quickly and in a more enduring way. So I got a call from some association of widows and widowers in New York City, and they said, well, come give a talk for our annual meeting. So I went into some hotel in Manhattan, gave this talk, and at the end there was Q&A time. The guy in the back of the room, he started waving his hand frantically, Liz, and he said, I don't care what you say, buddy, I don't do nothing for nothing. And the point there was that even though you can talk about these internal benefits, people are still limited by their ideas of pay it back, reciprocal calculation, tit for tat. You can just put all that on the side because there's in general, for most people, there is a kind of byproduct of just sincere, well-intentioned, helping behavior, and that is that you get these kinds of benefits that this national study clarified very nicely.
Many years I've worked with hundreds of different nonprofit organizations through my public affairs work, and absolutely everyone who comes in and talks about these organizations, all the volunteers, they all say the same thing or similar, which is I went to help others and I felt like I was getting more out of the experience than those people that I went to help or those animals or that situation. It did so much for me. So it definitely seems that it works.
Yeah, it's called the helper therapy principle. And it has all kinds of roots in Plato and in Carl Jung and so forth. But in modern times, it really goes back to Bill W. and the founding of AA. He was an alcoholic in New York, went into a detox unit, and somehow he saw some kind of a light, otherwise specified. He never drank again. Got his job back. They sent him to Akron, Ohio. The business deal didn't work out. He was despondent. He's in the lobby of the hotel. He sees the bar across the way. He's walking in there, and suddenly he realizes his only way to stay sober is to help another alcoholic. So he has a dollar in his pocket. He gives it to the bartender. He says, bartender, give me 20 nickels. Takes the 20 nickels. He goes to the telephones along the wall, and he starts calling ministers and rabbis from the list that they have there next to the phones. And finally, nickel number 19, Reverend Tubbs. Reverend Tubbs, this is the strangest phone call you ever got. I'm a guy from New York, and I know I'm going to go back on the wagon if I can't find someone right now to sit down with and help them because they have my problem. So Reverend Tubb said, well, I know just the person. And he connected Bill with Dr. Bob, who was an alcoholic surgeon at Akron General Hospital. They got together, and that night and the next day, they formed 12 steps. And the last step is helping others, especially other alcoholics, because that's where you have this feeling of empowerment. It's a kind of grassrootsy thing that you have insights into this situation. And definitely, you have to set an example. You need to be committed. You need to be there and present and attentive. So you're going to have to be a role model, just inevitably, in order for this to make sense. That's why people in AA all over the Western world make so much of this. But there are so many organizations now where even medically we can recommend helping activities in geriatric units, in adolescent psychiatry, even in pain clinics now, because people in pain, when they go out and they start helping folks, they report a reduction in pain levels. This is all good.
Are these practices being implemented in our school systems, in our graduate schools? Are we teaching nurses, doctors, teachers these things?
Well, I'm writing a lot about prescribing, or to use a softer word, recommending helping activities. I'm in a department of preventive medicine, and we think it's very, very important in many, many categories, not just for prevention, but for the recovery. I mean, we have a group here, most hospitals do, called Mended Hearts, where people have had major heart surgeries. They're looking for meaning in their lives, and what they do is they work with the newly diagnosed who are on the docket for surgery or other major interventions, and they comfort them. They are there after the surgery. This idea of utilizing the insights that one gains from one's own struggles to help others is really pretty powerful. And in terms of schools and so forth, well, you know, in grade schools in Baltimore, but all over the country now, finally, kids are doing meditational exercises. And the results are absolutely phenomenal. The kids are doing better in school. They're less agitated. They're not as reliant on attention deficit disorder, pharma, if you will. They tend to get along better. They're less agitated. They're happier and the like. And this is really a powerful movement. It's all secular, so it doesn't get in the way of any kind of churchy, statey type issues. And you see it also in medical school. We have all of our meetings in this hospital anyway. We do mindfulness meditations for a few minutes. It's very helpful clinically and makes a big difference in people's lives. So I think the mindfulness meditation movement is making great strides at all levels. The great gal named Amy Lazarus, who's written a lot of books for young kids and then adolescents and then young adults. I think it's very important.
What would our country or world look like if everyone practiced empathic care in their work and home life?
The world we live in right now is a bit on edge, or at least it seems that way. Maybe it's because we're constantly fed a lot of very acrimonious material 24/7 over the media. I'm not sure. But certainly these kinds of behaviors. Now, by the way, you don't have to go up to the Rockies in Colorado and meditate for 6 weeks with advanced Buddhists to embellish your capacities for compassionate action. I follow the James Lang theory, which basically is the reason why people say, even if you're not really happy, smile, because if you smile, it'll make you happier. And there's actually some truth to that, that physiology feeds back into emotional circuits. And so if you simply, in that sense of tikkun olam, you know, just look at the person nearby and assume that there's something that you can do that is helping to them, that can be reassuring to them, that can convey to them that their lives have value and beauty and meaning. Any little thing you can do, the right word, the right action, just assume that you're the right person in the right place at the right time with the right gifts, just to make a positive contribution to the person who's right next to you. And that kind of thinking is very powerful. So action is important, but also, you know, taking the time to contemplate quick meditational events over the course of the day to kind of de-stress and focus on the meaning of life and what your ultimate purposes are. We do that all the time with the doctors around here because they're feeling, if I can use an expression, they're feeling like canaries in the coal mine. I mean, they're seeing patients every 15 minutes. They're hectored about money. They don't have time to connect with the patients empathically, which is what they came in for, into the field for. And so they really need time to step back, collect themselves, even have retreats, which we sometimes do, which are meditationally based, so they can kind of refocus themselves on their professional purpose. And that is very, very important because, last year we had 500 doctors who killed themselves in America. That's higher than the general rate per capita. And if you do these surveys from coast to coast, about half of doctors and nurses would quit if they could afford it, which just tells you that they're looking for meaning. They came into these fields for meaning, and we need to find ways to make that meaning possible again.
Stephen, I want to let our listeners know they can find out much more about you and your work. They can watch one of your TED Talks. They can see all the books that you've written on your website, stephengpost.com. That's stephengpost.com. Before I let you go, is there a question in your area of study that is still unanswered that you would love to figure out?
Well, it would be a very big question because, at some level, these kinds of behaviors and practices, they're person to person. They have to do with our everyday social lives and our internal conditions psychologically and spiritually. But at a certain level, you want to ask the biggest question of all, which is the one that all the Hindus and the Buddhists and the mystics have asked for thousands of years. Is there something about ultimate reality? Somehow underneath all of the energy and the physicality of the universe, is there something at the beginning that is a kind of energy of love? And when people have these mystical experiences and they report that sense of continuity, the sort of loss of boundaries, the strict differences between self and other, and they feel a oneness, to use the word, a oneness with the people around them. Is that real? Is it what we need to think about with physics and mathematics and neuro research? I'd like to see us get to those kinds of ultimate questions at some point.
Dr. Stephen G. Post, Director for the Center for Medical Humanities, Compassionate Care, and Bioethics at Stony Brook University Medical School. Thank you for joining us today, one-on-one.
Thank you, Liz. It's been a pleasure. I wish you well.
You've been listening to A2A One-on-One, an outreach project of the nonprofit Adversity to Advocacy Alliance. To listen to other one-on-one interviews and to learn more about A2A, please visit us online at a2aalliance.org. And thanks for helping us spread the word that we help ourselves by helping others.